This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Alice Hinman was looking to renovate. She's got multiple homes in Raleigh, but the insulation just was not up to snuff, even for North Carolina's mild winters. Pests are getting into the home, the floor plan not comfortable for living. And the design of this home was really an 1851 original by a Philadelphia native named Langstroth. His designs now were revolutionary at the time. They included removable walls that can easily accommodate additional stories, which made the house easy to, you know, grow and shrink as the family did. I mean, you know, there are some years you've got 20,000 siblings. Other years it goes up to 80,000. And probably at this point, I should say the homes we're talking about are beehives. And Alice is a beekeeper, and she really was looking for a new design for her hives. After some research and experimentation, Alice knew she needed some expert help on her renovations, so to make sure her bees' new homes would be comfortable and as comfortable as possible, she reached out to local furniture makers and architects. The unlikely collaboration proved fruitful, and their first prototypes now face the ultimate test of the coming winter. Alice Hinman is founder and executive director of Apiopolis Urban Bee Sanctuary, and Richard Stevenson is here as well. He works at Flitch Furniture as a ratio rationalist. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you. So, Alice, tell us more about this redesign problem. What got you thinking about this?
So, I'm a natural beekeeper, and part of Apiopolis's goals is to work toward restoring honeybees to health, and shelter is one of the areas that need improvement.
So, what is it that you notice? I mean, what happens from year to year, and why did you think the problem might lie, or at least part of the problem, in their home?
You know, I studied biodynamic beekeeping and have been doing a lot of research, and I think that nest scent and warmth is really important to the health of the colony. So, started tinkering with things on my own to make a better house, and then. In some of the studies I was looking at, Dr. Seeley is at Cornell University, and he looked at the feral colonies that are thriving on their own in the Arnett Forest and compared how they keep themselves and are doing well and how we keep them as beekeepers, and made suggestions for how we could be better stewards.
Talk about the design that we're currently, because I think anybody who's ever seen an apiary at all, you're driving along and you see them in the fields, or you have friends who have an apiary, you got these stackable boxes, essentially, and those are the hives. Tell us about those. They have an interesting history.
Mm-hmm. So, as you said, Reverend Langstroth patented those in the 1850s. What he did that was innovative was used bee space, which is the amount of space the bees need to be able to work between the honeycombs, to design his system. So it had removable frames. So that was the first time that happened with beekeeping. And it made it so that, as you said, we could increase the colonies and make be able to harvest honey without destroying the bee colony.
Yeah, because up until then, and this is fascinating to me, up until then, the bee husbandry had been going on for a long time. It goes back, I think, 4,500 years at least. We've got evidence that the Egyptians were doing it. But I guess mostly, and even hunter-gatherer societies had figured out that if you use a little bit of smoke, you could get more honey, right? So that goes way back to even before we began cultivating bees. But apparently, up until the 19th century, if you wanted to harvest the honey, you had to pretty much destroy the hive. Mm-hmm. And that meant, you know, maybe we get more bees next year, or maybe we don't. So now we've got this kind of this stackable home that we can build, and we can count on them staying there. We can get the honey and leave them alone. That's not quite good enough, and you realize there can be improvements, and so that's when you call Flitch Furniture, and Richard Stevenson enters the story. Talk about your first conversation with Alice.
That's right. Well, so we're in Raleigh, like Alice is, and we had a workshop for children to build a bluebird house. And we designed the bluebird house around our furniture construction method so that the children could interact in woodshop. Posted this Instagram, and Alice saw it and recognized it immediately as an opportunity for her concept to come to life. And so Alice contacted the office, set up an appointment, walks in, and with all these parameters, and, you know, tried the best we could.
Well, so talk more about that. Now you make furniture. You can also show kids and others how to make a bluebird house. Now you've got to make this apiary. What do you do next? Or beehives, essentially.
Yeah, so the first thing is to identify the parameters. And Alice had all that data. And so we applied it to our materials, you know, and our assembly methods, and made a few kind of prototypes or just working components. Reviewed those with Alice on several occasions, made adjustments, and so we're pretty close to the final hive now.
So what kind of data do you bring?
So again, Dr. Seeley's work, so thinking about how the bees on their own would live in a hollow tree cavity and what elements are in that home that make it a better shelter for the bees. So try to incorporate as many of those.
So what are some of those? What do they do in the wild that might not happen in your
so, hives? There is habitat for beneficial microorganisms. I think in a natural colony, there are 8,000 beneficials that coexist with the bees. The interior of the tree is rough, so they propolize that entire nest space, and that has it's like a medicinal shield around the brood nest.
Do they not do so propolize? You mean they use some of their body fluids and they dress it up a little bit, and it does create both a barrier, right, and it's also got some medicinal use. That's propolizing. Do they not do that in your hives?
So propolis is they gather plant resins and it's sticky. Mm-hmm. So they won't propolize a smooth plain surface.
Uh-huh.
So they'll propolize, you know, different places in the colony, and they use it to fill voids, or if something is in the colony that they can't remove, they'll cover it up. Like if a mouse dies or something, they'll encase it in propolis. But for a long time, because it's also very sticky to work with, they were trying to breed that out of the bees so they wouldn't propolize as much.
Oh, wow. So they're breeding that out. And as you say, with a smooth surface, they don't feel like they need it. So maybe the jagged edges, they consider some kind of danger, or if it was organic, it would, you know, create disease, all of that. They're not going to do it so much. And so what did you assume then was the value, I guess the medicinal value of
it
this?
It increases the social immunity of the organism rather than the individual immunity. So the whole colony is healthier with this in place.
All right. So Richard, then what do you do with information like that?
So, we take that in consideration, of course, the interior wall surface. We're not modifying our raw material as much because it's already a little on the rough side compared to, you know, most surfaces. We do take into consideration the ecoflora that Alice is promoting, and then the quilt box, which is kind of an HVAC system. The ecoflora is a place for pest control, where you have these
beneficials.
Yeah, the beneficial pests and things live underneath the hive. And then above in the quilt box, it's literally a canvas material inside the top of the hive that's moisture control. And
we'll talk more about the ecofloor. What is that?
Mm-hmm. Else?
So if you think about a hollow tree cavity, there would be the detritus that falls naturally and creates an environment for those other microorganisms. So I started adding that to my Langstroth hives a couple years ago with native soil. There are soil-dwelling mites that prey on varroa mites, other organisms, but native soil or, you know, branches that had lichens but organic matter.
So you just add dirt to your box.
Mm-hmm. So, and then I used decaying wood chips. Mm. And so next I think I'll use straw, but some kind of organic matter under the brood nest.
All right, and yeah, go ahead.
And so you were talking about the mock scorpion, I think is one of the
pseudoscorpion.
Mm-hmm. yeah that's it. So we just provide that environment based on the critters that Alice is telling us what they're going to be living in there.
And does that have to be in any particular special space, or can you just dump it on the bottom of the box? In other words, do you have to create a well for that?
We do, yeah. So, and there has to be drainage in it, so it's not heavy water flow, but there has to be air movement in there. So there will be, it's a perforated bottom that's part of the leg assembly, and you know that we brought the leg assembly over from Flitch and applied it to the hive. And
is there anything else about furniture design, the whole profession of furniture design, in broad strokes that you could apply to this, you know, the comfort of humans, the comfort of bees. I got to know, you know, how a bee is designed and what its ratios are, any of that.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, for furniture, we're always considering human factors. And so the parameters that that a human needs to function, there are ideal angles and positions for humans to function, this desk, for instance, and the height of this chair seat. So the same occurs for the bees, except it's, you know, the scale is different. The proportions are the same, but it's just a different size. So,
for instance, I didn't realize this until I got ready for this show, but bees have are very fussy about the aperture that they use to enter and leave their hives, right? Is that right?
So, you know, there are arguments around the world whether the entrance should be low or if it should be high, and what happens, you know, in either location, how big it should be. I think that, you know, if the bees were deciding on which house they were going to move into, there would be other criteria that would be higher on their list of priorities, but entrance, you know, would be.
And they fix it up. So if the hole is too big, they make it smaller.
They make it smaller with propolis.
Mm-hmm. With propolis, that stuff. You can't get enough
with
of
magic,
that when you got bees.
It's like Bondo, yeah.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. It sounds like this could work wonders, though you haven't really tested the latest design yet, right?
We've constructed several. We're building one today. But we have two in the field, two of the outer envelope. The interior is slightly different, and that's a different animal altogether. But the testing, Alice, if you want to describe how that's going to take place.
So we've been testing, you know, earlier iterations this summer. So if you think about, you know, of course there's a seasonality to what the bees are doing. So now isn't really the time for building. That's early spring when the nectar flow is on, the colony is expanding. So that's going to be when the critical testing will happen. But we have two of the envelopes in the field. And then we made the system so that it was compatible with the Langstroth system, so you could transition into the new system with that equipment.
Does that mean that they're stackable? I mean, is that a value? It would seem to me that that would be valuable for beekeepers to be able to have, you know, conserve space.
Mm-hmm. To be able to investigate. So ultimately, the goal is to have the brood nest be an undisturbed space, so that would be a larger unit than what you would see in the Langstroth system. Right now, it is compartmentalized so we can transition into it, but ultimately it will be a solid piece. And then, you know, so my goal is not production, honey production. I do harvest if there's surplus. I do a lot of robin hooding where I'll share, you know, from strong colonies and give it to weak colonies. But I can't tell other beekeepers, hey, we want you to buy this new system and you can't have any honey. So we did make it so that you could have a limited space for honey. Mm-hmm.
So what is the value? Because it does seem to me if it's going to catch on, it's going to have to have that commercial value, mm-hmm. right? What would be what's the disadvantage in encouraging that, or is there one encouraging honey production?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Seeley is one of my favorite researchers. Jürgen Tautz is another one. He's a German biologist. And his research assistant, Torben Schiffer, is doing amazing work in Germany, installed a colony in an observation hive in his home, and he chose the colony because he said they were lazy. They weren't producing a lot of honey. So he would, you know, volunteer that one. And then being able to watch them, they said, well, these bees aren't lazy. Look at what they're doing. They're working and taking care of each other and everything. And so he started doing studies like, the more space that we give our colonies to make honey that we're going to harvest, the harder they're working.
I see.
So they
doing all their energy is going into home improvement.
All their energy is going into production, and then it's called effective grooming. So then they're not taking care of themselves and their sisters, and that impacts their health. So
I see. So let me ask you this, because it's my understanding that the honeybees and the honey that we get are from, you know, essentially, you know, European honeybees. These are not feral bees, and they're not the kind of bees that we'll find in the wild in North America. Is there any correlation between making a healthier habitat for these domesticated bees and the feral, the wild bee population?
Are you talking about feral honeybees or like native bees?
Well, let's talk about, you'll have to distinguish those two for me, because I thought I was talking about the same thing, so apparently not.
Okay, so Yes. So
good
we.
Good question, Alice.
So you're right. The honeybees aren't native to North America. You know, Africa, Italy, Russia. But they've been here for so long. Mm. You know, when the settlers brought them over, the Indians called them white man's flies. So they have.
Yeah.
We do have feral colonies that exist in. All around
right.
the North
and then
America.
There are native species that would be
and then the native pollinators
the
are
yeah.
You know the native bee folks are worried about honeybees because it's competition for already scarce resources mm-hmm. and in terms of food and with habitat removal and they're worried that some of the pests and diseases that the mm-hmm. honeybees have will spread to the native bee populations. So ultimately, healthier honeybees would mean healthier native pollinators.
That would mitigate some of the fears
right.
that the people right. have. Go ahead.
So I was going to say, you know, I only use my own bees that are showing local resilience, and so I make increases from those survivors. So I don't buy package bees or mm-hmm. nucleus colonies. I just keep making increases, and I catch a lot of swarms. So hopefully some of those are feral colonies.
And the better they do, the better all of those bees will do. We'll try it. Now, one last question, got to keep it very short. Mm-hmm. Is it going to cost a lot more to make these than the old ones?
A little bit more. I think the final cost will be slightly more. The benefit is great mm-hmm. for the health of the honeybee, the future of the honeybee colonies.
Well, I want to thank you both for being on mm-hmm. the program today. Richard Stevenson and Alice Hinman. Richard is a ratio rationalist. We never did get to define that.
Yeah, well, so it hasn't been defined yet, but, you know, welcome to.
That is my job description from this day forward. From Flitch Furniture, Alice is founder and executive director of Apiopolis, is Raleigh's urban bee sanctuary. Thank you both so much for being on the program.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You can find out more. It's still actually happening. Oh. It hasn't ended yet. I have to tell everybody that they can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org, and then I tell them that North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Then I say my name, then it's over. I'm Frank Stachow.